Well, thank you, Jessica. Let me begin by articulating what most of us are probably thinking at this point. What? Because this text has got all the ingredients, hasn't it, to be outlandishly difficult to understand and apply. Long names, obscure places, supposed differences with the New Testament, ethical conundrums, dark humour, gratuitous violence. What more could you want on a Sunday morning? But specifically, what are we supposed to take away from Judges 4? Is it hospitality and hammers don't mix? If someone's wife gives you a glass of milk, you know what's coming. Or Kipling's poem, "The female of the species is more deadly than the male." Well, to help us this morning, it would be good to set a bit of a context and then to recap the story. Judges records the time after Israel entered the Promised Land, maybe around 1250 BC, to the time of the monarchy, about 1000 BC. Some may find it an entertaining book, but actually it's quite a sad book. A broken record repeating the cycle that we see in verses 1 to 3 of Judges 4. Israel's disobedience to God, God giving them over to their enemies, Israel's crying out to God for deliverance, God sending them a deliverer, a judge, to defeat their enemies, only for Israel to disobey again. And so it goes round. In this cycle, God has handed Israel over to a Canaanite king called Jabin, with his 900 iron chariots and his merciless tyrant of an army chief, Sisera, bent, according to chapter 5, on plundering Israelite men and raping their women. So into the breach steps a deliverer, a judge, who also speaks God's words to Israel. But this is a judge with a difference. Not a hero, but a shero, a heroine. And so we are introduced to Deborah, the prophetess, who you would have noticed is, say it quietly, a woman. For some of you here, that's not surprising at all. Why should it be? A woman, verse 5, who settles the nation's disputes underneath her very own palm tree. A woman who is the God-appointed prophet for the whole nation. You might say that that's not a surprise because, quoting our prime minister, are there really girl jobs and boy jobs? But for others here, Deborah as judge is a big shock, perhaps even a problem for you. How does this sit, you ask, with the New Testament's teaching that for men and women, equality of worth does not imply identity of role? But if it is a shock for you, a female judge, a female prophet, you begin to understand how Judges 4 was first understood by the original Israelite readers. In a society much more patriarchal than our own, Deborah is an unlikely deliverer. She is an unlikely deliverer, but that's who God chose to use. That's the explicit point being made. Deborah is leading Israel, a woman with the eyes of faith. Deborah, whose name means sweet bee. One commentator said, somewhat wistfully, she's a sweet bee because she stings her enemies and provides sweet refreshment for her people. And God raises her up as his plan A. Evidently, there's a chronic lack of action from the men in Israel at the time. Certainly a lack of leadership. A situation we may have today when we consider that most evangelical mission agencies report that whilst 2/3 of their missionaries are married couples, of the remaining third, 80 to 85% are women. Women rise up and take the lead when the men are too scared to do so. Certainly that's what is happening here. One such man is Barak, who is told by Deborah, verse 6, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his troops to the river Kishon and give him into your hands." Barak said to her, "If you go with me, I will go, but if you don't go with me, I won't go." "Certainly, I will go with you," said Deborah. "But because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman." And of course, we as readers are supposed to think, well, that will be Deborah. Watch out for the twist. But maybe we miss something of the cultural humiliation that Barak would have felt to be stripped of honour and that honour given to a woman in the context. In 1973, a young woman, the famous Billie Jean King, was challenged to a Battle of the Sexes tennis match as a publicity stunt by Bobby Riggs, a former Wimbledon champion, who at 55 thought he still had it in him. Bobby Riggs practiced in a t-shirt that read, "If I am to be a chauvinist pig, I want to be the number one pig." But before a live audience of 30,000 and a global viewer audience on TV of up to 90 million, Billie Jean King trounced Bobby Riggs in straight sets, 6-4, 6-3, 6-3. Riggs was humiliated. That humiliation is but a poor reflection on the cultural humiliation inherent within this passage for both Barak and Sisera to come. A humiliation we may find it hard to grasp today. So what happens? To cut a long story short, the 10,000 Israelite troops assemble on Mount Tabor, just southwest of what would become Lake Galilee. And with Deborah's prophetic encouragement, verse 12, the Israelites descend the mountain to attack, the Lord using their geographical advantage to destroy Sisera's troops and his 900 chariots. Humanly speaking, a surprise result, but exactly what the Lord had said through Deborah. Verse 17, Sisera, however, fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, because there were friendly relations between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the clan of Heber the Kenite. Or so Sisera thought. Cue heroine number two, Jael, who, despite her Hebrew-sounding name, was a Kenite, a nomadic group of metal workers, take note, associated, yes, with Jabin, but also with the tribe of Judah. Split sympathies. So Jael's appearance in the narrative is mysterious. She's like a new character in Game of Thrones. You're not quite sure which side she's on. And she lures Sisera in. Verse 18, "Come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid." 21st century readers will think seduction, but we can't be sure. But Sisera, I wonder if you can imagine, shattered in mind, weary in body, caked in perspiration from fleeing the fighting, is lulled into a full sense of security from this femme fatale. And he thinks, well, no one's going to look for a man in a woman's tent, except maybe a woman. And he asks her to stand at the door and lie for me if anyone comes. So in Caesarea goes, he lies down, he is covered by probably a fly net and accepts some yogurt, some curdled milk, a sign of hospitality. And shattered, Caesarea sleeps. But then, hospitality turns to horror, the despicable act, treachery. Given that pitching tents was at that time a woman's job, let's just say that quietly and efficiently, Jael makes excellent use of her tent peg and hammer skills. Verse 21. She drove the tent peg through his temple into the ground, and as one insightful commentator said, that's going to leave a mark. Israel's persecutor meets a swift and gory death at the hands of a woman, a disgrace in the view of that age. And to complete the narrative, and for Barak to see the prophecy of verse 9 coming to pass, we read verse 22, just then Barak came by in pursuit of Caesarea, and Jael went out to meet him. Come, she said, I will show you the man you are looking for. Black humor alert. So he went in with her, no doubt Barak rehearsing what he's going to say to Caesarea, and there lay Caesarea with the tent peg through his temple, still dead. Well, throughout history, there have been many attempts to capture this moment in art, from the medieval paintings of Italian artists depicting Jael as a prefiguration of the Virgin Mary, to the silent French film, Jael and Caesarea, of 1911. But I think my favourite representation has to be this characterisation from the Brick Testament. Well, we might have the same reaction to this story as the first time we read it. What? What? But let's remind ourselves again of the impact that reading this would have had on the first readers before we look at it through the eyes of the rest of the Bible. The thrust or the point of this story is God is able to use the most unlikely of people to achieve his purposes. In this instance, Deborah and Jael. This is the original girl power. And with sincere apologies to the Spice Girls, both Deborah and Jael trust it, use it, prove it, groove it. Both were women, unlikely deliverers in context, and in Jael's case, not even an Israelite. But they were still part of God's purposes to deliver Israel, even if in God's ultimate sovereignty, it's God who gives Israel over to their enemies in the first place. But it is God who saves, it is God who delivers and uses whomever he wants to achieve that. Now, this is not to say that in the New Testament there is no structure for leadership and roles. Clearly there is, but it is to say, don't count yourself out and make yourself unavailable for serving God simply because you're not sure what you can offer. Make the most of every opportunity that God gives you, and don't shirk your responsibility by letting others do the work of the kingdom when you could be. God doesn't need us to do anything because God is self-sufficient. But God wants us, and he asks us to be part of his kingdom plans and purposes. He wants us to be a Deborah, not a Barak. Despite Barak getting into the Hebrews 11 Hall of Fame, not Deborah, how did that happen? Deborah is the one honored here. She is the one with faith. She is the one with vision. She is the one who is obedient to God's word. And ask yourself, how can I be a Deborah willing to serve God in my workplace, in my staff room, in my neighborhood, in my family, in this church. Last Sunday morning, we had a fantastic opportunity to greet and to welcome and to share with 50 or so guests who came to that week's dedication service. And of course, there were some people here who seized that opportunity with both hands. They got up and they welcomed our guests before and after the service. They talked to them about Jesus and what it means to follow him. Fantastically encouraging. But of course, I would guess, and it is only a guess, that maybe there were others here who, for whatever reason, seeing the opportunity to welcome and greet guests and to speak of Jesus, stayed firmly rooted to their seats, refusing to take the opportunity. Like Barak and Deborah, if you don't serve God, someone else will, but you're missing out on the joy and the delight of being part of God's purposes. Judges 4 shows us that we cannot say, but I'm not qualified to speak for Jesus. I'm the least likely person that God could use. This passage blows that attitude out of the water. Saying, I can't be used, is akin to saying, I won't be used. It puts the emphasis on my perceived inability, or worse, my flat refusal, and not on the all-sovereign God who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine according to his power that is at work within us. So please don't say to yourself, God can't use me, making that an excuse to stop serving him somehow. God can use you. He can use anyone. He can use the most unlikely, and he wants you to come on board with his plan for his world, not your plan for your world. Think of other little people of the Bible who didn't make it into this sermon series, the unlikeliest characters whom God still used. Shiphrah and Puah, two midwives who dared to defy Pharaoh because they answered to a higher power. Bezalel, a simple architect to whom God gave the job of a lifetime. Ehud, used by God for no better reason than he was left-handed and available. Asa, a son of godless parents who became a mostly godly king. Asahel, a fleet-footed sprinter with a tenacious heart for his king. And Hushai, a covert counselor for David who successfully infiltrated enemy ranks. Unlikely people, but just like Deborah and Jael, used by God. So remember, God uses the unlikely, and that includes you and I. But put into the context of the whole Bible story, what is it that God, the real judge of Israel, is achieving in Judges 4? Well, the Song of Deborah, Judges 5, which dates from before Judges 4 was written, makes it clear that God was on Israel's side. He fought for the men of Zebulun and Naphtali. God's acts in chapter 4 were righteous. His enemies perished, it says, because ultimately God, as judge, was judging evil, as he always has and always will. God judges evil. I hope we can see, even if both Old and New Testaments condemn human treachery, murder and a spirit of revenge, at the same time, if you can conceive this, God's judging of evil is achieved through it. That's why in the Song of Deborah, Jael's actions are glorified because they led to God's victory. Of course, we can justifiably ask, how does God's concern with the thing he wants done relate to his concern with the motives and the methods of the person who does it? How do they relate? But even if we don't have a full answer to that question, we are seeing through God's sovereign plan and those through whom God chooses to carry out that plan, evil defeated, evil being crushed, evil humiliated. There is judgment on evil. The Israelites were suffering under cruel and prolonged bondage, with the constant threat of rape and pillage, and evil that God needed to judge. Arthur Kundal and Leon Morris write in their commentary, "Perhaps it is too facile for those who have not endured extreme persecution or bondage to pass judgment on the Israelites of old, or the survivors of the Nazi prison camps in our own generation." Well, recognizing the reluctance we should always have to compare anything to Nazi Germany, maybe there is a parallel there between Israel's attitude and actions towards Sisera and his army and someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German pastor and anti-Nazi dissident, in his part in a plot to assassinate Hitler, for which he was executed. That was Bonhoeffer's Christian response to evil. In Judges 4, God's plans somehow connected with people's role. But we're acknowledging from this passage that it is God who deals with all evil, finally and fully. And he does that through the means with which he has chosen. In Judges 4, those means were the particular people of Deborah and Jael. But ultimately, evil past, evil future, is dealt with definitively at the cross. For it is at the cross where God chose and used, you could say, the unlikely, his own son, to die a sinner's death, to put all sin and evil to death. And from there he rose victoriously, defeating evil, triumphing over the ultimate enemy of death itself. And so God has dealt with and defeated evil. That doesn't mean there is no sin in the world today, but it does mean that at the end of time, God will come to judge all people, looking at whether their sin, their evil, has been dealt with through Jesus' death and resurrection, or whether someone comes to him still carrying their own sin, refusing to be forgiven by God. God punishes evil. He defeats his enemies using the most unlikely means possible. This, friends, is our God. This is his way. This is his plan. Let us worship him for who he is and for what he has done.